From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, our election roundup, including the road ahead for re-elected Boston Mayor Marty Walsh.
Whether we've been together for 20 years or just got involved this past weekend, from the bottom of my heart, I want to say thank you.
Also today, Framingham elected its first ever mayor.
Here is a kid from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And even though I've lived here for 32 years, I'm still not a what we call a townie, can come to Framingham and see opportunity.
And Newton chooses its first woman mayor.
Newton stands at a crossroads. We need to roll up our sleeves and get to work together.
Plus, we'll talk about the new diverse makeup of Boston City Council, and Maine expands Medicaid. All that and more coming up next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we've got a lot of election results to analyze today. We're going to hop around the state in the next hour to take a look at all that happened last night. And we're going to start right here with the Boston mayoral election. Boston Mayor Marty Walsh was reelected last night, taking 65% of the vote over his challenger, City Councilor Tito Jackson. So let's find out what this means from Adrian Walker, columnist for the Boston Globe's Metro section. Adrian, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
So what do you make of Mayor Walsh's victory last night? Does he have, in your mind, a mandate?
I think he has a serious mandate with a 30-point win. And, you know, they say that it's only when you're reelected that you're a true incumbent. So now he's, you know, sort of a mayor in full. He's in charge.
There was a relatively light turnout, right? I'm reading roughly 28% here. I mean, does that affect the mandate at all?
No, not really. I mean, not in any practical way. I mean, obviously, it's always better if more people vote, but no, I don't think it affects his influence.
Okay. So what do you think, what are your views on what Walsh's top priorities ought to be?
Well, you know, right now he's the mayor of a city that's on fire, and he's got to think about how to manage that growth. He's got to think about what he wants to do in terms of development. Obviously, he's strongly in favor of it. But, you know, with that development has come a lot of pressure, particularly in terms of affordable housing and just in terms of keeping working class people in the city. I think that's going to be one of the major challenges, clearly, in the second term,
Yeah. Along
with education and other perennial issues like that.
It makes me wonder that, in a way, does Marty Walsh have kind of an interesting challenge in front of him, in that he's got kind of an enviable challenge, that he's the mayor of a growing city. But, you know, now that he's been reelected, it's in part up to him to help the city grow in the right way, which may be harder to do than we think.
I think that's true. I mean, a lot of these issues are hard to manage at the mayoral level. They're driven by things that are not always entirely within your control. You know, when you talk about great wealth coming into the city and how you preserve the working class under those circumstances. Of course, you know, that's where his heart is. That's where his personal background is. But it's what's going to happen to neighborhoods exactly like the one he grew up in Dorchester that's the issue he's going to have to manage here in the second term.
Mm-hmm. Well, what do you make of the way the race was run? I know that there were some people who were rather critical of the race, saying that we didn't have enough debates and that perhaps there wasn't enough interaction between the candidates. Do you think any of that mattered when it came to the final vote yesterday?
I don't know that it mattered in terms of the final vote yesterday. I suppose it didn't. But I do think there could have been a more robust campaign, and I certainly would have liked to see more debates. But, you know, look, the reality is, you know, no sitting mayor in Boston has lost since, I believe, 1949. You know, mayors come in with overwhelming advantages, and they use those. And I think his challenger, Councilor Tito Jackson, was always up against it from day one.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking of that, we actually have some tape from Marty Walsh's victory speech last night. And here's a moment where he thanked Councilor Jackson for a spirited campaign and then addressed Jackson's supporters.
And to all of your supporters, the people that went out and voted for you, I want to say thank you. Thank you for making your voices heard. And let's come together and build a city that is truly for all of us.
Adrian Walker, a third of the voters who cast ballots yesterday in Boston did cast their ballots for Tito Jackson. I mean, what do you think Marty Walsh needs to do in order to prove to them that he's a mayor for them as well?
Well, I mean, I think the way to build bridges for them to them is to address the issues Councillor Jackson talked about. I mean, the thing he really ran on was the issue of income inequality in the city, and I think his supporters want to see that Mayor Walsh is serious about Boston not becoming a city of haves and have-nots.
Hmm. Now, in your column in the Boston Globe today, you wrote about a particular challenge that the mayor may be facing, and that is turnover on his staff, right? Like you noted that Dan Coe, the mayor's former chief of staff, is now running for a congressional seat. Lydia Edwards is now a Boston City Councilor. I mean, how much of a challenge is that for any mayor?
That's a challenge because as people begin to assess what they want to do with their own lives and careers going into a second term, you know, it's sort of a four-year commitment, at least in theory, and a lot of people are going to think about whether they really want to be around for another entire term, particularly people who are holdovers, department heads, who are holdovers from the Menino administration. I mean, there are people in City Hall who've been there for a long time, and they're really going to have to start to think about how much longer they want to be there.
Well, Adrian Walker is a columnist for the Boston Globe's Metro section, talking to us about the significance of Marty Walsh's re-election last night. Adrian Walker, it's always great to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we should let you know that we did reach out to Mayor Walsh today to see if he could join us. He's unable to join us today, but his staff says he'll try to get to us and have a conversation with us, hopefully sometime in the next couple of days. So we're looking forward to that. But while I have an opportunity, I also want to say that, as I mentioned before, a third of the voters who cast ballots yesterday in Boston did cast their ballots for City Councilor Tito Jackson. And Councilor Jackson joins us now in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me, Magda.
How are you doing today?
I'm doing super. I believe that the city of Boston is better today than it was yesterday. I want to congratulate Mayor Walsh on his victory, but I also know that the things that we brought to the table, the conversation shift, the narrative shift in the city of Boston was important. Everyone is not doing well in Boston, and things are not going great for everyone in this city. And it is critical that we have leadership that acknowledges that, that not only acknowledges it, but actually does something about those issues. In particular, with structural issues like racial inequality, it's not enough. We can't pat ourselves on the back for having a conversation. And in fact, for not even acknowledging that Mayor Menino had a conversation for a year in 2003. People are looking for action. With the issues around housing, we know that 5,000 eviction proceedings happened last year in courts for Boston-based people. You know what? That means in the next 4 years, if we don't deal with that, that means 20,000 people. And mind you, that didn't mean everyone got kicked out, but it definitely means that those issues are real. And issues around schools. I had a bunch of young people in my office working, those who actually led the walkout. We have to deal with these issues, and we have to roll our sleeves up right now.
So, Councilor Jackson, let me ask you, I mean, about housing specifically, but also about education, but really about housing. You've been talking about, you talked about it every day over the course of this entire campaign, every single day. And, you know, we've got tons of polling and also just common sense that said it was the number one issue in the minds of Bostonians. But you know, you got a third of the vote. Marty Walsh got two-thirds of the vote. Yeah. I'm wondering why you failed to connect on this like key issue.
That's
voters.
Actually not true, okay. Magna. He spent a little bit more money than me.
Several million.
Yeah. So I'm actually pretty proud of what we were able. First off, Mayor Walsh did not use the word gentrification prior to January 12th and that I know of. And so having a conversation about displacement, gentrification, and people getting pushed out was not being aggressively had in the city of Boston, and people weren't holding his feet to the fire. So that is a critical component. So I don't believe that this is about and actually what I would say to you is that the win from my campaign is that the things that we put forward, he adopted. Let's look at this issue of the disparities around contracting. And so there's something that there's a prerequisite to having goals for women and people of color to get city contracts. They have to do a study. It's called a disparity study. Mayor Walsh promised he would do one day one. You know what? You know when he announced it? The day before our first debate. That made, there's progress there. Immigrant Legal Defense Fund. When I put that forward, he said it was a slippery slope and didn't want to do it. And now there's an Immigrant Legal Defense Fund. Question number two, I actually did 12 debates statewide and really led the effort. He jumped in the end. But question number four, he was against, and now he's actually adopted. We are making, we made some progress there, but the people of the city of Boston and the over 30,000 people who voted for me, they want to see action. They want to see it urgently, and they want to see accountability in this next term. And that's why we're not going away.
Yeah. So, I mean, about question two and question four, just to be clear, that was in the 2016 election cycle. But let me ask you, though, then practically speaking, what are the things that you would like to see Mayor Walsh accomplish in these next 4 years that he has? And what role do you see for yourself?
So I'll start with the second question. I'm not going away. I have lived in this city. I love this city, and it's given me all that I am. And we are pulling together a coalition that is going to be citywide, and it's going to continue to bring up these issues of income inequality, the disparities that we are seeing, the need to close the achievement gap and full funding for the Boston Public Schools, and we have to stop the violence in the city. We are going to continue to hold to account all of those, not only the mayor, but all of those in elected office and who are supposed to be doing this work. And we will have an opportunity to speak about that later after we pull folks together. But that is absolutely critical. We live in a city that has some of the highest income inequality in the whole country. So when you say, again, when you say things are going great, well, you know what? Not for everybody. We live in a city that has some of the highest wealth inequality and a wealth gap that is nearly a quarter of $1 million between a white family and a black family. So we have a lot of work to do there. On the first, he has to deal with the issues. Development isn't in its development isn't good just because it happens. If they put forward housing that people can't afford, you can't count that unit as affordable. There was a unit at Ink Block, and someone did one of the folks pulled this out online. It is $3,400 for a one bedroom, and it's considered an affordable unit
for someone making $125,000.
For someone who makes $125,000, 50% of people in Boston make $35,000 or less. So that means the units that we are building, even for $70,000 to $120,000, which is our current affordable definition for families of four, we're leaving people behind. And we need a city, we need a government that sees that and deals with those issues right on and with urgency.
I'm not going to ask you the do you regret you ran question, because of course not. But I will ask you, is there anything you would have done differently in your campaign?
Anything I would have done differently? Hey, I would have loved to have raised a whole lot more money. Sadly, and it's so interesting, this component around money, because we have people who say that they want to get money out of politics, but at the press corps, if you go back and look at the number of stories, and I haven't gotten a chance to do this, most of the stories in this election cycle were about me not having money, or it was in every single one of the stories. So there's this validity test.
But that was
a
fact of the campaign,
though.
Well,
but I understand. But the question is, it wasn't a question about ideas or visions or plans, or even when I did put my budget out, it got absolute short shrift when I actually put the budget out, which actually showed that we could do some different things. That's the one factor. But you know what? I would have done it again all day, every day, 10 times a day, because of the people that I met in every neighborhood, from South Boston to Hyde Park to Roxbury to Dorchester, who are going through the same exact things. The most amazing team that I've of people who care. Because if you're working for me, by the way, we didn't have a lot of money. So you weren't doing it because you were getting paid big bucks, right? You were doing it because you believed in our ability in Boston to make sure that the power goes to the people, not those in power, not those who are profiting.
I want to play a piece of tape for you. Yesterday on WBUR for our election night special coverage, we had on Michael Curry, former head of the Boston branch of the NAACP. Now, he didn't weigh in with an endorsement during the election. Last night, though, he said this.
Do I think that voters of color and communities really knew what was at stake and what measures to look at evaluating this mayor? No.
Michael Curry then went on to say that he thought that the NAACP report card that came out relatively late in the campaign didn't come out in time for folks to really evaluate Mayor Walsh. I should note that Mayor Walsh and his campaign had a point-by-point rebuttal, essentially, of the report card. And, you know, maybe in a future day we will dive into that. But I just wanted Councilor Jackson to hear what you thought about Michael Curry saying he's not sure that voters of color really knew what was at stake.
I don't think people realize the urgency of what's going on. When I started, there was 14, 15 development projects in my district. Now you're talking about 50, 60 at a time. When I started, we were, and we did it on a biweekly basis. We actually looked at and sat down with developers who were doing things in my district on a biweekly basis. Right now, there's too many of those sites in my district to even deal with right now, to deal with every one of them. People are getting pushed out at the fastest rate that I've seen. And I think to Michael's point, listen, we spend $1 billion a year in Boston, just of your money on city contracts. Less than 2% under this administration, under the Walsh administration, goes to women and people of color-owned businesses of $1 billion. That's happening right now today. When we look at healthcare disparities, when we look at housing, when we look at schools, still many kids are caught in the achievement gap, and it's actually growing rather than contracting. Our schools are being underfunded. And so, yeah, we have a lot of work to do, and I believe that to be the case.
So last question for you, Counselor. In a way, I feel like what I'm hearing you, how I'm hearing you now makes me think that that your campaign, not for the mayorship of Boston, but your campaign for Boston, right, is not going to end, which is great. But I do also want to ask you, do you feel optimistic about Boston's future under Mayor Marty Walsh?
I believe and think that Mayor Walsh. Well, so let's actually set the record straight. I backed Mayor Walsh in 2013. We had a conversation. Actually, I think we were closer than you and I are right now, Magna. The reason why I ran I want people to understand, was not to take out Mayor Walsh. It was because the things that we talked about face to face were not done. The people who should have had opportunities were not actually at the table to have those opportunities. Olympics, IndyCar, all GE. Those are distractions from what the people of the city of Boston actually need, that they want, and they deserve. In addition, we also
But let me just say, I'm asking you about, do you feel optimistic about Boston's future under Mayor Walsh?
But you know what? I do believe that Mayor Walsh has an opportunity to do some great things. I was optimistic when I was yelling on stage for him in 2013. My question right now is not about optimism. It's about accountability. And that's what I'm going to work for. And that's what my coalition is going to work for. And so he has a chance. He has an opportunity. And he definitely does need to know that there will be accountability this time. There wasn't last time, but there will definitely be accountability this time. So I am optimistic that he will heed the things that I put forward. And I look forward to that being moved forward with urgency.
City Councilor Tito Jackson, I have to say, and I say this to everyone who runs in every race, thank you for being part of the democratic process. Thank you for joining us today, and we look forward to continuing to hear from you about all the things that Bostonians care about. Thanks again.
Thank you for being part of the democratic process.
And let me remind folks that Boston Mayor Marty Walsh and his staff say that he will be joining us in the coming days, so we look forward to hearing from him. We'll take a quick break and be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're spending most of this hour talking about the results of last night's election. Let's move up north, where Maine has become the first state to expand Medicaid through a voter referendum. Mainers approved the expansion 59-41% over the objections of Governor Paul LePage. And for more, we're joined now by Patty White, reporter for Maine Public Broadcasting. Hi there, Patty.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, how significant was yesterday's vote to expand Medicaid for Mainers?
It was very significant. I mean, this is something that the legislature has actually passed five times in the past several years. It's something that people wanted during that time, and Governor LePage vetoed all of those legislative attempts, and so that's why supporters of Medicaid expansion decided to put it on the ballot. So it was a big sign that this is something that people want.
Well, and it won pretty handily, again, that 59-41%. I mean, what were you hearing from some voters about why they were voting for it?
They were voting for it because they didn't like that people couldn't access health care. That was, you know, the supporters of Medicaid expansion in their campaign, they really got out a lot of the stories of individuals who are affected, who don't have insurance, and I think that's really what brought a lot of people out. But also a lot of people who work in healthcare, who see people who don't have insurance coverage, they were motivated to vote too.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned Governor Paul LePage's opposition to expanding Medicaid in Maine. And to that effect, he actually issued a statement just this morning saying that his administration, quote, will not implement Medicaid expansion until it has been fully funded by the legislature. Can you explain what the governor meant by that?
Well, so Governor LePage, you know, he's opposed this before, and it sounds like he really is not, he doesn't want this to pass because he said that the legislature has to fully fund it, but that they can't raise taxes, and they also can't use funds from the rainy day fund. So it kind of sounds like his plan is to basically kind of gum up the process and delay implementation because, you know, even though voters approved this, now it's in the hands of the legislature. It's like a bill, and the legislature can change it, and there can be delays. And the big question with this is how is this going to be funded? Because even though there's going to be a big injection of federal dollars, there needs to be some state funding too, about $50 million a year, and the legislature has to figure out how to allocate that money before it can be implemented.
Do you think they can do that? I mean, given the fact that the legislature in Maine itself had approved Medicaid expansion several times.
You know, that is the question. And even though it has won approval in the legislature, it has not met the bar of a two-thirds vote to override Governor LePage's vetoes in the past. And so, you know, that is the question is, will there be enough this time around? In the past, there haven't been enough votes.
I see. Now, help us with some context here, because, I mean, Governor LePage has been talking about how back in 2002, there was a form of expansion under then-Governor Angus King, and he called that, LePage called that disastrous for Maine's economy.
Right. So that Maine did, you know, Maine was one of the first states to have a more generous Medicaid program. It did end up ultimately leaving hospitals. The state had a $500 million debt owed to hospitals. But the reason that happened, supporters of Medicaid expansion say, is because Maine had a way that it funded hospitals. It gave them weekly payments, and then it would settle up at the end of the year. That was implemented before Medicaid expansion back in 2002. But then once the state expanded Medicaid, there were higher costs. Then healthcare costs in general increased. There was also the recession. So there were all these factors that created this debt. And once Maine changed the way that it paid hospitals, things got better.
Right.
But so supporters kind of say, look, that was a different time. And also at that point when Maine expanded Medicaid, there was not this higher federal match that Medicaid expansion offers under the Affordable Care Act. So even though it did sort of, there were some issues before, supporters would say that it's not really a great comparison.
I see. So last question, Patty. I mean, in the event that the Maine legislature does find a way to fund the state's portion of this Medicaid expansion, and meaning Governor Paul LePage eventually, if he does, implements it, how many more Mainers may have access to health care?
Estimates are about more than 70,000 Mainers, so it's a lot.
Wow. Well, Patty White, reporter for Maine Public Broadcasting, bringing us up to speed on Maine's last night's voter referendum to expand Medicaid there. Patty, thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, it was also a very big night in Framingham last night as voters elected their first mayor there, their first mayor ever. Back in April, Framingham voters did narrowly approve a measure to change Framingham from a town to a city. That was a very narrow vote, 104 votes between those two groups. But now the city of Framingham has elected its first public officials to craft the new government, including political newcomer Yvonne Spicer. She is the mayor-elect of Framingham, and she spoke with WBUR's Bob Oakes this morning.
What's your most important priority now for your new city?
Well, the most important priority is the smooth transition, of course, and making sure that as we move forward to becoming a city, that we all are on the same page. And me personally, making sure that I'm connecting with the community, that they understand the process and know that they are an integral part of the process.
Let's talk about some of the challenges. There are plenty of empty offices and shopping plazas in the downtown area of Framingham. It was a big point of discussion during the campaign. What kinds of businesses do you hope to attract, and how will you get them there?
We need to be thinking about the innovative economy and how to grow in Framingham, how to make sure that we have a strong hold on that, where new businesses can start in Framingham and scale up, and also certainly employ all of our residents. And if we have that anchoring, particularly in the downtown, we have an opportunity to make sure all of our other businesses are supported.
Another major challenge is taking on low-performing schools in Framingham. I know you were a teacher, so what's a policy you'd like to get off the ground in your first term that'll help improve the schools in Framingham?
I would be working very closely with the superintendent to look at some of his plans to address our underperforming schools. And certainly, you know, even though I have expertise in STEM education, I would offer that as an opportunity to forge those relationships with the school department and the city government and bring my expertise to the table.
Over the last many years, Framingham has been a magnet for immigrants from other countries. What's your message to the immigrant community in Framingham this morning?
You are welcome in Framingham, and that's one of the things that has been a beauty of Framingham, is our very diverse population of immigrants. In the 32 years I've lived here, that has been the case. So nothing has really changed about that in Framingham, and I actually feel having our population of immigrants being a part of the government is also critically important, that everyone feels like they have a seat at the table. So that will certainly be a part of my administration.
Let me ask you one more question. It must be exciting to be the first ever mayor of Framingham. You're doing something that hasn't been done before. Is there anything that makes you a little nervous?
You know, I don't think there's anything that makes me nervous. It makes me hopeful. Here is a kid from Bed-Stuy, Brooklyn. And even though I've lived here for 32 years, I'm still not a what we call a townie, can come to Framingham and see opportunity. And so this is a representation, being a woman, being a person of color, that transcends what we need in Framingham. What is most important is that we're working together to build our new city.
That's Framingham Mayor-elect Yvonne Spicer speaking with WBUR's Bob Oakes this morning. Well, we're joined now by Jim Huddedeen. He's a reporter for the Metro West Daily News, where he hosts the Making a City podcast. Jim, it's good to talk to you again.
Thank you very much for having me.
So Yvonne Spicer won the Framingham mayoral race over the more established political candidate, former state rep John Stefanini. I mean, what do you think the message is that voters were giving with Spicer's win?
So, you know, you heard there, she's a very charismatic woman. She's got a very inspiring personal story. I think that connected with a lot of people. She used education to lift herself up, went to college on a scholarship, and I think that appealed to people. And she also really tapped into a network of support for Democratic women in the state. So she had backing from Emily's List. She attended a boot camp this summer from Emerge Massachusetts, which is a nonprofit that provides training for Democratic women seeking office. And I think that really helped her get out the vote and get this network of grassroots supporters from people both inside and outside of Framingham.
I was just wondering how much of the tensions or the divide over whether or not Framingham should even become a city in the creation of a new city charter bled into the election yesterday, because John Stefanini, who was also running, I mean, he helped write Framingham City Charter. Was that sort of a distrust of the formation of city government part of what was going on yesterday?
So that was really an undercurrent in the election. Putting aside, you know, Yvonne Spicer's own personal talents and her ability to woo people, this was in many ways a kind of a replay of the April charter vote. And I think that was to John Stefanini's detriment. He was on the Charter Commission, was really a leading voice for the town to become a city. And after the fact, the vote did kind of split into two camps, those who wanted to stay a town and those who were with John and wanted to become a city. And I think talking to him last night, he felt like it was just a deficit that he couldn't overcome.
Right. Well, you know, so that means that Mayor-elect Spicer has kind of an interesting challenge ahead of her, right? Because part of her coalition, she'll have to reach out to those people who are still possibly dubious about Framingham even being a city. I mean, how important is it going to be for her to unite a divided Framingham electorate?
Well, she campaigned on the idea that she will use her personal integrity to lead this new city administration, and she contrasted herself with Stefanini in that way and kind of raised doubts in people's minds about whether he could be trusted to take over this really politically powerful position in the new city government. So I think she's cognizant of people's fears about what's going to happen when they lose their town meeting system and you have power concentrated in fewer hands, and I think she's laid out some steps to try to proactively address that, things like hiring a neighborhood services director, setting up these kind of community listening sessions, and I think people will be looking to see in the first few months of her administration, you know, whether those are really meaningful opportunities to provide feedback, how, you know, public feedback is going to be incorporated into meetings of the city council and things like
yeah.
that.
You know, I love the fact that we're talking to you because you are the man behind the Making a City podcast, which is exactly what Framingham, that's the job the city has ahead of it, right? Because, I mean, it's not that often that a town in Massachusetts converts to a city. So in a way, we're sort of seeing in real time this wonderful civic experiment going on in Framingham. I mean, Jim, I guess that's my long-winded way of asking you, like, what do you think are sort of the biggest challenges ahead in the shaping of the city government?
Well, it is, you put your finger on it, it's a very exciting time for this community. It's an exciting time for us watching it. I think in other parts of the state, there's kind of goodwill for a town like this that's willing to really re-examine, you know, the patterns that it's fallen into over the years and what's working and what's not. So I think people really want this to succeed. There are some really obvious pragmatic things that need to happen in the next 6 months. And right when the new city council and Mayor Spicer take office in January, we're going to be right into budget season. So this is going to be the first time the budget's going to be under the mayor's control. She's going to have a seat on the school committee for the first time as well. The kind of chief executive for the town is going to be working with the superintendent and the school committee, albeit in a non-voting role, but to try to figure out what makes sense for the budget and how that's going to come together. And there are also, I mean, there are very small things that need to happen. The charter obligates the mayor to come up with a master plan, to come up with a long-range strategic plan. They literally have to take the word town off of all the stationery and put in the word city and come up with a new city seal.
Wow. You know, I mean, these may seem like small things, but all of it, every single decision is going to set the tone for Framingham, the city, as the months and years go by. So Jim Huddedine, reporter for Metro West Daily News and host of the Making a City podcast. I have a feeling we're going to be checking in with you quite frequently, Jim. What do you think?
We'll let you know how it's going.
Okay. Thanks so much. And and we'll talk to you again sometime soon.
Thank you very much.
And now let's just move over to Newton, where Newton voters last night elected their first female mayor. City Councilor Ruth Ann Fuller beat City Council President Scott Lennon by just 344 votes last night, so a very tight race. And we're joined now by Newton Mayor-elect Ruth Ann Fuller. Welcome to Radio Boston.
Magda, thanks for inviting me on.
Congratulations first on your win last night. I'm just wondering how you feel today about it.
I'm excited and grateful and honored.
And so, again, I was just reading that, to folks, I just reminded them that you won by just over 300 votes. Just your reaction to that.
It was tight.
Yeah, I mean, what's your reaction to the fact that it was so close?
My opponent, Scott Lennon, is a good man and well-known and well-liked. I have respect for and affection for him, too, so I understand why so many people chose to vote for him.
Yeah. And so your biggest, what do you think is your biggest priority upon your inauguration?
First step is, with such a tight election, is to make sure everyone knows that City Hall is open to everybody, regardless of who you voted for. And we also had kind of a divisive issue on what our charter should look like going forward, and that was on the ballot. And it split the city a bit as well. So first thing is getting us united and back working together.
Yeah. Okay, so can I ask you a little bit more about that, Mayor-elect Fuller? Because you're right. There were some issues that, I'd say, the charter part aside, there were other issues which we've been wrestling with kind of as a nation and definitely as a state that really were laid bare in Newton, issues of gender and class, really. And I was looking at the results from the election last night. And, for example, the wards where you where Mr. Lennon beat you, wards 1, 3, and 4, mostly. I mean, it's almost like if you put those wards on the Newton map, there's such a strong divide between North and South Newton. So, what are the practical things you're going to do to show everyone that you're a mayor for all of Newton?
We planning right now in the transition to make sure that when we put together a transition team, it is inclusive of everybody here in Newton, regardless of whether they live north, south, east, or west. And going forward, we have to make sure that there is genuine input on a regular basis that is affecting the decision-making at City Hall. So I've been knocking on doors in all 32 precincts for months and listening to people. I want to make sure the doors of City Hall are also open, so I keep listening and hearing and making sure our decisions reflect the needs of everyone in this great city.
Yeah. You know, I was reading a Boston Globe story about the Newton race. It was published before election night, and there was an interesting line the Globe had. It said that families are drawn to Newton for its public schools, and some voters had told the Globe if they wondered that how you would grapple with a school's budget when you don't have a personal history in that your kids didn't go to Newton Public Schools. And I just, you know, now that that's going to be your job, I'm wondering what your response is to that.
Absolutely. The schools are the magnet for Newton. Yes, we've got a great location and a great community, but it's both our moral center and our economic driver. I'm absolutely committed to making sure Newton schools are we're going to aim high, are the best in Massachusetts.
Well, Ruth Ann Fuller is mayor-elect of the city of Newton. She's Newton's first female mayor. Congratulations on that, and thank you again so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Magda.
We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and we're talking about election results last night in and around Massachusetts. Historic results yesterday in the Boston City Council election, because Bostonians elected the most diverse city council in the city's history. 6 of the 13 city councilors are now women of color. And as a comparison, let's just remember that 8 years ago, back in 2009, when Ayanna Pressley won a seat, she was the only woman on the council, and she was the first woman of color ever to be elected Boston City Councilor. And that was just back in 2009. Yesterday, Ayanna Pressley won her 5th term. And among the women joining her on the council, Lydia Edwards. She won the seat for District 1, which includes Charlestown, the North End, and East Boston. She was formerly deputy director of the Mayor's Office of Housing Stability. Lydia Edwards, welcome back to Radio Boston, and congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
So first of all, how do you feel about your victory last night?
I feel elated. Our team was just amazing. It's just great to see hard work pay off. Feels great.
And so what does it mean to you that you're now one of 6 women of color on Boston City Council?
To be very frank, it means I'm proud of being a woman of color, but that's it means more that our message that connected beyond color lines, political lines, that we built a coalition that had Trump supporters, that had Bernie supporters, that had folks who had never voted before, that didn't speak English. That diversity means a lot to me.
Well, because I've been seeing, you know, longtime watchers of Boston politics say that it's about time because the city council, you know, should start representing more of what the city looks like. And I'm just wondering how important you think that is in terms of the work that the city council does.
Well, I think any government body definitely we should reflect the folks that are going to be directly impacted by them. So, yes, having half the council be people of color in general, I think is just reflective of Boston and where the demographic changes or trends are going. And I think in terms of, you know, impact in terms of that being the new council, I think you'll see it a lot more in the kids who are watching and a lot more in the young people who are thinking about politics or people who may have not thought politics was for them, but until they see maybe someone like Michelle or Ayanna, and then they think, wow, I mean, that helped me looking at Michelle and Ayanna.
Wow, okay. Well, so let's look forward here a little bit. I mean, what would you say are your immediate policy priorities once you begin work on the city council?
I think what the first thing I actually want to do is a listening tour and get throughout the entire district and talk to folks, whether they were with me or not, and just to hear from everybody or as many people as possible to talk about, you know, kind of the message that I had and that, you know, for them to really direct the agenda from day one. But a part of the message that I had that I think resonated was really talking about our housing and making sure that we are a part of, you know, leading the city in stabilization and assuring that folks feel that they can still stay here. And that's through pathways of ownership, that's through looking at ways in which we're bringing small property owners to the table and just figuring out a combination of ways to move, and this is partly from my job before, to move the
right,
city
at the Office of Housing Stability when you were the director there.
Yes, the Office of Housing Stability. But to move the city in a way that folks, we're growing our middle class and still developing, and instead of feeling that we're displacing our middle class, our working poor, and our working class.
Yeah. So, I mean, speaking of that displacement, back in 2014, I mean, we have some numbers that say that more than 5,000 no-fault eviction cases appeared in Boston Housing Court. And that's an issue that's especially touched some of the neighborhoods that you're now representing. Like, I'm thinking of East Boston.
Oh, yeah. No, I think displacement certainly is an issue. And the question is really, how do we not only stop that, but, I mean, when we're building so many units in Boston, it's not for lack of housing, right? It's for lack of people, normal people being able to have access to that housing. Or when they are in housing, for them to stay. And so when we build units, when the city is building affordable units, if they're, you know, for me, if you're not building it with a way as a pathway out of poverty or a pathway to gaining equity and wealth, then you're missing half the sentence. People are definitely able to stay. You're able to pay some your rent on a monthly basis. But if in 40 years, which is happening to a building in the North End, in 40 years, I think their 40 years is coming up, excuse me, and they are where they were when they started. It was a deed-restricted building that was deeply, deeply affordable. And now, 40 years from now, they have been paying rent at deeply affordable rates that no longer exist. And they're wondering if this building is sold at market, which it may be, they're all going to be homeless. So that was 40 years, I feel, that we kicked the can instead of coming up with ways to pull people into a pathway of ownership, gaining equity, and figuring that out.
Right.
So, and that's what I think our policy needs to change.
So Lydia Edwards, let me ask you. I mean, you were at the Office of Housing Stability, so you were working for the city. You had a relationship with Boston Mayor Marty Walsh. Ostensibly, I mean, that's a very influential position when it comes to things like housing policy. I mean, what do you think you can accomplish on the city council that you couldn't get done at the Office of Housing Stability?
Well, I think there's not had a good relationship. I have a good relationship with the mayor, but also I think that there are several things that can be done when you are the elected official. One, you're leading the conversation from your district and from the grassroots. And when you're in an administration, you tend to be responsive to, which is not a bad position, right? You have resources, you have researchers, you have all these different things coming to help you respond to those things. But here, I think as a city council, you can lead the conversation. You can suggest certain things. And of course, you can introduce and produce and move ordinances that, again, working with my other council members and then getting signed by the mayor, can go on to the State House to become law. So that you certainly couldn't do when you're in the city council, or excuse me, in the administration. I think you can also challenge more readily what's going on. And also, I think what's really exciting about this position, it's very close to being a community organizer, which is what I come from. And so if Amazon is going to be making its home in East Boston, what I couldn't do as the deputy director, but I can do as city council, is demand a seat for my district at that table, and making sure we're negotiating the best deal for not only just East Boston and my neighbors here, but the district and Boston as well.
My eyes just went wide because you did indeed remind us that the city of Boston's bid for Amazon does focus on Suffolk Downs. So Lydia Edwards, newly elected city council elect for Boston's District 1, congratulations again, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for this opportunity. I really appreciate it.
And we've got news today that actor Kevin Spacey is facing new allegations of assault right here in Massachusetts. A former Boston news anchor, Heather Unruh, says at a press conference today that Spacey sexually assaulted her son at a Nantucket restaurant in the summer of 2016. Maria Garcia, reporter for WBUR's The Artery, joins us now with more. Hi there, Maria.
Hi, Meghna.
So you were at this news conference today. It seemed rather emotional. What did Heather Unruh say?
It was emotional, Meghna. Heather Unruh arrived with her attorney, Mitchell Garabedian, and her daughter, Kyla, who's not part of this case but was there for moral support. And Unruh really fought back tears the entire time as she, for the first time, really detailed the alleged sexual assault of her son in a public setting. She said her son was not ready to be there, but she was there to tell his story. And according to her, Kevin Spacey and her son met at a restaurant called Club Car on Nantucket. She didn't say whether the encounter was planned or why they were both at the restaurant. We do know that, she says that her son is a fan of Spacey, though Garabedian wouldn't provide details as to how they met there. But Unruh said her son, who was 18 at the time, told Spacey he was old enough to drink. She said Spacey bought her son drink after drink before allegedly slipping his hand under her son's pants and touching his genitals.
This was completely unexpected. And my son's efforts to shift his body to remove Spacey's hand were only momentarily successful. The violation continued. My son panicked. He froze. He was intoxicated.
Now, Kevin Spacey allegedly tried to get her son to accompany him to a party, right? But he did not?
That's right. Unruh said her son left the restaurant when Spacey went to the bathroom, and another diner at the restaurant, Meghna, a woman who just happened to be there as well, went up to Unruh's son, asked him if he was okay, noticing that he was in distress, that he was in a state of shock, she says. And then this mystery woman, Garabedian is calling her a mystery woman, told her son to run away, at which point he did.
Now, this assault allegedly happened last summer on Nantucket, but Unruh and her son just filed charges last week. Now, why is that?
Yeah, she said they filed a complaint last week. The department, though, the Nantucket Police Department, wouldn't confirm that open investigation, citing state confidentiality laws to us. But yes, Unruh said her son was not ready to come forward before last week, though, because he was afraid of, you know, the kind of attention that would be bestowed on him if he did. She said she was also scared for her son, for the way he'd be treated if he came forward. She talked about online trolls and how there's a ton of people behind computer screens who say really vicious things in comment sections. And so she says her son, you know, still is not ready to publicly speak about it, and until last week was not ready to even go to the authorities with these allegations. But after dozens of women spoke publicly against Harvey Weinstein and then actor Anthony Rapp accused Spacey of assault, Unruh said she and her family really felt ready. She said the voices of those prior alleged victims paved the way for them. But she also said there's just irreversible damage.
Well, I should note that Kevin Spacey's agent and another representative for him have dropped him, and Netflix has also stopped production of House of Cards. So we have yet another case here of allegations against Spacey for assault, this one taking place in Nantucket. WBUR's The Artery Reporter, Maria Garcia, thank you.
Thank you, Magna.